communications people in the White House were doing opposition research on me and sending out to the press these statements that everything I was saying was wrong. Could you imagine how crazy that is, that you're working in a White House that is trying to discredit you? It's almost unbelievable.
Hello, my name is Andrew Pollard. I'm director of the Oxford Vaccine Group at the University of Oxford. Welcome to our podcast series, The Oxford Colloquy, Trust in Science, bringing you the stories, facts, and people behind the science. On this podcast, I'm really excited to be speaking with Dr. Anthony Fauci, the chief scientific advisor to seven US presidents, about his experiences from the discovery of HIV/AIDS through to the recent pandemic of coronavirus in 2020.
Anthony Fauci, director from 1984 to 2002 of the United States National Institute for Allergy and Infectious Disease, advisor to US governments through that period, including an astonishing seven presidents. Thank you for joining us on this podcast today.
My pleasure. Very good to be with you, Andy.
So, Tony, you have won numerous awards for your work in science over your career, and you're also a physician as well as a scientist. But it all started in Brooklyn, where you grew up in the 1940s and 50s. Tell me about that time and what it was that then helped you make the decision to go into medical school and start this career that you've had.
Well, I was born and raised in a working class section of Brooklyn, New York, called the Bensonhurst section, which is mostly working class, first and second generation immigrants, mostly from Italy. My father was a pharmacist, and he had a drugstore in the middle of this working class neighborhood that is very different from the pharmacies of today, because this is the 1940s and 50s. And back then, the pharmacist was kind of like the surrogate doc of the neighborhood. He would be a marriage counselor. He would be somebody that would advise people on their delinquent children if they got in trouble, but also dispensing prescriptions that were written by physicians. And very often they couldn't pay the bill. And my father would have people put the bill on a tab, as he said, and they could pay later. And often they couldn't pay. So one thing he wasn't a very good businessman, but he cared very much about the community. And he instilled in me from a very early age, as I was delivering prescriptions on my bicycle throughout the neighborhood, that the important thing is to care about people, particularly people who are in less favorable circumstances than you are. That inspired me to have this feeling that it is important for service for others. That was underscored and strengthened in my elementary school's training. I went to a Catholic elementary school taught by nuns, and then I went to a high school and college taught by Jesuit priests whose theme was service for others. So going back retrospectively, when I wrote the memoir, it sort of became very clear to me that this idea about doing things for other people was sort of part of my DNA from an early age. That's what got me to be primarily a physician. Becoming a scientist, that came later on as I got introduced to the issue of science and what science is capable of doing.
I should say that when you mention your memoir, this is the new book that's just launched a couple of weeks ago called On Call, which describes some of these experiences through your career, which we'll touch on just a few of them today. So, Tony, after you started medical school, or you had those studies, what was it then after that, when you finished medical school, that made you shift to science rather than carrying on as a physician, as you say, with that background of service and caring for individuals?
Well, you know, it's very interesting, and I think is an example for younger people, that careers are very often not linear. They take different twists and turns when things happen that you did not anticipate, but that changed the direction of your career. The example in point for me was my major desire was to continue and finish my multiple years of residency training in internal medicine. And I wanted to get additional training as a fellow in infectious diseases and immunology. So I took a fellowship at the National Institutes of Health, which brought me down to Baltimore, Maryland. My major intent was after those 3 years to go back to New York City and practice medicine as a practicing physician or in a New York hospital, in a teaching hospital. I wanted to be academic, but I really wasn't really directed towards fundamental, basic, or clinical research. That changed when I went down to the NIH. Not only did I get training in clinical infectious diseases and immunology, but it introduced me into the world of biomedical research. And I found that very attractive because of the intellectual stimulation, but also attractive because of the fact that I realized that if you could make a discovery in a clinical trial or in an observation you made about a pathogenic process, that you might have an amplifying effect that would benefit more than just the individual patient that you're taking care of. That changed completely the direction of my career, because instead of going back into private practice in a New York hospital, I came back to the NIH after another additional year of chief medical residency and began a research career that went for 50 plus years and only recently ended in December of 2022.
And so at NIH, although you have an interest in infectious disease, as I understand, a lot of your work was actually on rheumatological diseases during that period. And those are the diseases where inflammation occurs in the body, and it's sort of generated by our bodies. It's not thought to be from external factors, at least thought at the moment to be. And your work was really about how to control those diseases rather than infections.
Well, absolutely correct. And in fact, even though I was clinically seeing infectious diseases as an infectious disease consultant at the large NIH hospital, my own personal research, being a hybrid between an infectious disease person and an immunologist, I get very involved in auto-inflammatory diseases, as you correctly indicated, predominantly the vasculitic syndromes that at that point had almost 100% mortality. And my colleagues and I developed a therapeutic protocols which used drugs that had been used predominantly in high doses for cancer chemotherapy. And we induced a 93% remission rate in them. That all went very well. And for 9 years, I did that from 1972 to 1981. Then in 1981, when the first cases of what would ultimately be HIV/AIDS, though at the time that I began seeing those patients, it didn't have a name and it didn't have an etiology, that completely turned around the direction of my career. So it was really kind of the big, you know, landmark in my career was when I switched directions and began intensively studying these almost exclusively young, otherwise healthy gay men who were coming in with this horrible disease that would be killing them in 10 to 12 to 15 months. Here were these patients who early on, epidemiologically, even though we didn't know the etiologic agent, unquestionably had a sexually transmitted infectious disease. It was staring us right in the face. And when you looked at what was going on pathogenically, their immune system was being destroyed. So I said to myself, oh my goodness, here I am trained in infectious diseases, trained in immunology. I have to study this disease.
So, I mean, you would obviously made some very important observations on HIV, but actually, when you look at the history books, I think you will be defined as the mastermind of the funding that then has really changed the way HIV is treated, the PEPFAR funding. So how did that come about, and what were the obstacles, and maybe even the obstacles before that in getting HIV recognized in the US?
Well, you know, getting HIV recognized in the United States was tough early on, because I first became director when Ronald Reagan was president, and he was a good man, but he really did not use the bully pulpit of the presidency to call attention to this emerging disaster that we were seeing predominantly among gay men, but then injection drug users and commercial sex workers. Over the period of years, as you know, we had no therapy from 81 to 87. AZT was approved in 87, and then it wasn't until 1996 when we had the triple combination, which was underscored by the protease inhibitors. But from 1996 to 2000, we went from a disease that was almost uniformly fatal to essentially people living an almost normal life expectancy, maybe cutting off 3 or 4 years, depending upon how long they had been ill. The thing that impressed me in my new role as, well, relatively new now, I mean, probably 20 years into it, as the director of an institute, I became very taken up by the fact that we in the United States and in the European Union and in Canada and Australia, you know, relatively rich countries, people were had access to drugs. In my multiple trips to Africa and the Caribbean, it became clear that my colleagues and your colleagues, I know you were doing the same thing, you know, my colleagues in Africa were in the same boat that I was in 1982. But in 1982, I didn't have any drugs, so I couldn't treat my patients. In 2000, 2001, in Southern Africa, there were drugs, but they couldn't afford it. So I felt we needed to do something about it. So I was pushing to be able to get a program. Fortunately for me, and fortunately for the developing world, George W. Bush, our president, you know, obviously a controversial presidency, but one thing he did that will be always remembered in a positive way is that he told me, he called me into the White House and said, you know, I feel, I being him, very strongly that the United States has a moral obligation as a rich country to not allow people to suffer and die from a treatable and preventable disease merely because of where they happen to have been born, namely in a poor country. So we said, go back to Africa and figure out and put together a program that's accountable and that's transformational for treatment, prevention, and care. And I told him, I said, you know, Mr. President, that's going to cost a lot of money, billions. And he said, let me worry about the money, put the program together. So I did, and I presented to him over several months in the year 2002. And then in January 28th, 2003, he announced it at the State of the Union address. And my proposal was $15 billion over 5 years, 14 countries, treat 2 million people, prevent 7 million infections, and care for 10 million people, including AIDS orphans. He accepted it. It was a bipartisan authorization and appropriation. 20 years later, we had a celebration here in Washington, D.C., with George W. Bush and his wife, Laura, and the team that helped me put together the architecture of it. And we looked at the results. And now it was 50 countries, $110 billion, and 25 million lives were saved. So that actually turned out to be the largest and most impactful public health endeavor for a single disease ever. And what it did, Andrew, it really exemplified what can happen when you get leadership from the top, how much good can come from that.
But of course, one of the concerns today is that we're very dependent on that US funding, and that it creates, particularly with polarization in politics around the world, and it's not just the US, but that does create a risk to those sorts of programs that become very dependent on single countries. Well, are you concerned about that and why we haven't got more buy-in globally?
Yeah, well, there are a couple of things about that I think you're right on, Andy. That is a really good point. One of the things that what PEPFAR is trying to do now is to get the countries to buy in to their own responsibility for their own country and to put into a fund that is a public health fund that isn't dependent on the developed world, so that when things get shut off, they'll fall right back to where they were years ago. That's the first thing. The other thing is to get buy-in by many more of the countries of the developed world, you know, which is really part of what the Global Fund is all about. You know, the United States put a third into it, and other countries pledged the rest of the two-thirds. But you're quite right. If you're only dependent on one source, that's fragile, because if that source goes away, you can really lose a lot of momentum and maybe never gain back that momentum?
So you've been in those roles advising presidents for so many years through seven presidents. If you were to look at the HIV story, who would you want to have had as a president to support you right there at the beginning to get the focus in the US?
Well, you know, it's tough to make hypotheticals, but it was very clear that, you know, people like Bill Clinton and Barack Obama and even Joe Biden, if they were there in the very, very beginning, I know from my personal close relationships, you know, with working with them on other diseases, that they would have been very empathetic and reached out very quickly to the LGBT community and would have been very concerned and empathetic towards injection drug use, which they consider is a disease, you know, and not necessarily at all a crime. Early on, the very conservative approach in government was, you know, not the cause of the stigma, but it didn't do much to alleviate the stigma. And I think that someone who has a more empathetic liberal approach would have been doing something to kind of eliminate as much as possible the stigma.
So over the years after HIV, you were in charge during the 9/11 terrorist attacks and a big focus on biodefense then from the US, which I think arguably has put us in a much better position to understand pandemics. I mean, although the funding was focused on biodefense, it actually built an infrastructure in the US that doesn't actually exist anywhere else. And then obviously the 2009 swine flu pandemic and then Ebola. And of course, most recently, the COVID-19 pandemic, when something really on a global scale that affected everyone happened. And you were still there right in the middle of it, very much so on our televisions as well as in the US. When were you first aware that actually this one was different?
Well, it was a gradual process that took place over days, not weeks and months. I first, as I described in the memoir, the first I had heard about it is I got a call from a reporter on New Year's Day saying, you know, there's something strange going on with a strange kind of pneumonia in China. What do you think about it? And I said, well, you know, I better check it out. I really don't know. But you know, if it's China and it's a pneumonia, the first thing I thought of was the original SARS in 2002. And then the next thing I heard the next day or so is that what the Chinese are saying, that it likely is not very spread very efficiently from person to person, likely jumped from an animal to a human, and similar to the original SARS, probably could be very well controlled by identification, isolation, and contact tracing. So then we get into the first couple of weeks in January. We know it's a coronavirus. And then all of a sudden, the reports start leaking out of China that, well, wait a minute, it's spread a lot more efficiently than the original SARS. And then when the Chinese scientists who we were communicating with all of a sudden were told they really couldn't give any further information. And then when we saw from the satellite photos that the Chinese were building these prefabricated 1,000-bed hospitals over a weekend, then that's when it became clear we were in for some serious problems.
And I suppose at that time, you then found yourself in a political environment which was not accepting of a lot of the facts of the pandemic and the science. And I know you've always been someone who very much wants to use the science to lead the decision-making and to continue to speak the truth about that, despite the restrictions that you might get from a sort of much slightly less certain viewpoint from the White House. How did you cope with that view that was being pressed against you?
Well, you know, Andy, it wasn't easy. I mean, the people who are the extremists think I was doing it, you know, to undermine President Trump. That's the last thing in the world I wanted to do, because I have steadfastly stayed out of politics for the almost 40 years that I've been the director. You know, I'm not a political person. I have no allegiance to any party. I just focus on the science. In the first couple of months, the president was listening to what the coronavirus task force was saying, but he desperately wanted the outbreak to do what influenza did. In fact, he continually almost confused influenza with COVID in that, you know, it's going to go away as soon as it gets warm, right? No, there's no indication. And what happened is that then he started to realize this was interfering with the economy and would clearly have an impact on the coming election, which is what he was very much focused on. So then he started to say things that were just not true. When it became clear to him that it wasn't going to disappear, that's when he started invoking magical elixirs like hydroxychloroquine and ivermectin and things like that. That's when I knew I had to speak up, because I felt very strongly that I didn't want to undermine him, but I had to, first of all, preserve my own professional integrity. And I had my responsibility was primarily to the American public. And in some respects, because you guys in the UK were listening to me on TV also, I felt I had a responsibility to the people throughout the world to tell the truth. And I did. I said, I'm sorry, but hydroxychloroquine does not work. There's no clinical data to say that it does. And in fact, it could harm you. That then, somewhere around March and April, essentially unleashed big attacks on me, not necessarily by the president, because he and I had some sort of a comfortable relationship in that he kind of liked me and I had nothing against him.
Well, I know that he did say of you once that you're a nice man who's made a lot of mistakes.
Yeah, right, exactly.
So he obviously liked you.
Yeah, exactly. But then there was really a tsunami of attacks to try and undermine me. I, as a prominent, very visible scientist, was saying things directly contradictory to what he was saying. So the easiest way around that, Andy, is to discredit the scientist. And there was something that was, that I described in the memoir that was unheard of, is that the communications people in the White House were doing opposition research on me and sending out to the press these statements that everything I was saying was wrong. Could you imagine how crazy that is, that you're working in a White House that is trying to discredit you? It's almost unbelievable.
So, I mean, you've had actually over your career quite a lot of attacks on you personally. And I reflect back to the HIV days where you were called an incompetent idiot and a pill-pushing tool of the medical establishment. So I wonder whether those attacks that clearly are and have no scientific basis, they make no sense at all, but do they get to you personally, or did you develop an understanding of that world to be able to rise above it, as you must have had to in the pandemic?
Yeah, well, you know, Andy, you bring up an absolutely critical point that I'll just try to be succinct, but to explain it, because it's dramatically different. The attacks from the predominantly young gay community here, the ACT UP groups and those AIDS activists, and the attacks I'm getting now. And let me explain. Back then, and you know, because you're part of the scientific community understandably can be somewhat rigid. You know, there's very strict entry and exclusion criteria in clinical trials. The FDA is very rigid. They want to be very careful. They approve drugs measured in years and years of approval. Well, the community in HIV was saying, wait a minute, when we find out we're ill, we have about 10 to 15 months to live. Do the math. You're telling us, you know, wait a few years. We want to be part of the dialogue. We want to have some input into the clinical trial process, some input into the need for more flexibility from a regulatory standpoint. The scientific community, understandably, but completely inappropriately, were saying, we know what's best for you. Listen to us. We'll take care of things. So the AIDS activist community then said, So then they became disruptive, confrontative. And since I was a very visible figure in the United States, they picked me out. And that's when they said, you're the incompetent idiot. You're the et cetera. So one of the most important things that I did, and I'm proud of, is instead of being put aback by their confrontation, the way most of the scientific community was, even my own staff didn't want to have anything to do with them, I said, let me listen to what they're saying. And when I put aside the theatrics and put aside the confrontation, what they were saying was making perfect sense. And I said to myself, if I were in their shoes, I would be doing exactly what they were doing. You know, there's an iconic civil rights leader that just passed away in the United States named John Lewis. And when John Lewis spoke about the civil rights movement, he said, we made trouble, but it was good trouble. What the AIDS activists were doing, they were making good trouble because what they were saying was correct. They didn't have antipathy towards us. They wanted to work with us. Fast forward almost 40 years, and the attacks that you see now on me and scientists is pure ad hominem, pure vitriol, and pure anti-science. So it's a world of difference between what went on in the mid to late 1980s and what's going on right now. There doesn't seem to be any purpose to the attacks right now except to discredit scientists.
And science, to discredit science. And I know you personally have a huge sort of security concern as well because of the death threats against you. But that must be extremely difficult to cope with personally.
Well, it changes your life. I mean, I never would have imagined, you know, when I was leaving medical school, starting my residency, that because I have been trying my entire career to help preserve and protect the health of the American public, that I would need a security detail because people wanted to do me harm.
So as we look through that period of the vaccine development in the US, the huge investment there was, and moving forwards, do you feel like we did well in the pandemic with Operation Warp Speed, which drove the vaccine development?
Well, for the science, Andy, I think we did very well. I would give it an A+, because what it was decades of investment in basic and clinical research that led to the ability to use mRNA as a vaccine platform. Then you get Operation Warp Speed, which you've got to credit the Trump administration for that, to put in billions of dollars to not only fund the tens of thousands of people in the clinical trial, but to pre-purchase the vaccine even before we knew it worked. Now, as you know, no company in their right mind would ever start manufacturing hundreds of millions of doses before they knew the product worked. But Operation Warp Speed took that risk and completely de-risked it for the company. So from a scientific an implementation standpoint, we did very well. What we didn't do so well was in the public health arena. You know, and I often give the UK credit because they have a system where, you know, if someone comes in to an emergency room or a hospital, the data are very easily accessible in almost real time. Whereas in the United States, it's fragmented. So if there's anything that the United States needs to do better is to get to unify more a response and not have the fragmentation of the response that we had.
So when we look at where we are today, we've talked a bit about trust in science and this sort of anti-science world that we're seeing at the moment with a lot of polarization. And perhaps to some extent politically exemplified in the US, although I suspect that characterizing it like that's incorrect, that you can't divide science belief by political party. It's very much more confusing than that in the real world. But do you think we're in a better place for science today or a worse place when you look back over your career over 50 years?
I think clearly we're better off. I mean, what we're able to do, Andy, right now, I wouldn't have imagined in my wildest dreams when I was a resident in medicine in a busy New York City hospital. I mean, there's not a chance. So the science, the eloquence and the sophistication and the technical capabilities of science is great. What I worry about is something that you just alluded to a moment ago, is that the era of misinformation and disinformation, and what I refer to often as the normalization of untruth, that there's so much, mostly because of social media, spreading of things that have no basis in reality, that when you have a substantial portion of a population that lives in a silo of just echoing things that they want to hear, that the core about science, which is based on evidence, data, and reproducibility, we've gone far astray from that. I mean, very much so. So I think the core of what scientific capability is as stronger than it's ever been. But I worry about the disinformation and misinformation, which is really a counter to some of the positive aspects of science.
So, Tony, when you look to the future, do you think that we are on the right track with trying to improve communication about science? Are physicians like yourself and scientists engaging in a way that's actually going to be helpful for the future? Are we just getting it wrong?
You know, Andy, I have to be honest. I don't think we have it right yet. I think we're figuring out how to do that. First of all, there's some core things. We've got to be more science literate. I can't speak for other countries, but in the United States, we've got to get people to at least understand the scientific process. And we're not very good at that. That's the first thing. And it seems to me that the people who spread misinformation and disinformation seem to be very aggressively energetic about doing that. It's almost as if, you know, we're being outfoxed or outgunned or whatever you want to call it. So I don't know what the answer to it is, but for goodness sakes, we can't give up.
Do you think it's because we're just too timid about telling the truth and talking about things? Or do you think we need to actively campaign against the negative? Because I mean, my worry is if we do that, it just amplifies the negative, that what we're not doing well is just promoting the truth.
I agree with you. I always say, and I'll say it for you here, that the best way to counter false information is to flood the system with correct information. And that's what we need to get more energetic in doing, putting out correct, evidence-based, verifiable information.
Tony, you're 83 and you've stepped down as director of NIAID. There's a lot of discussion about age in politics at the moment. And I just wondered if you have a perspective as someone who's definitely still very much on it at 83, on age and how that fits into the presenting of science and also the understanding, the perspectives that you can bring when you're an older man compared with yourself back in the 1980s when you were fighting HIV.
Yeah, I think it's each individual, as you well know. But one of the things that I have found out, of course, I asked myself honestly, what is it that I can do now that I still am really very good at? And what is it that I'm no longer on the top of the list at? I am no longer one that can get in the lab and use the latest of technologies that, you know, in many respects have bypassed me. What do I have? I have good judgment, you know, I have experience, and I would like to maybe serve as somewhat of an inspiration to younger people, particularly scientists, about why it's so gratifying in the field of science, in the field of public health, and for some even in the field of public service. So there's no way that I'm going to now all of a sudden recreate my laboratory that I had in the 1970s, 80s, and 90s. That would be foolish. But there are fellows in my lab who are now senior that I can't teach them anything. I could learn from them, but I can't teach them anything. But I can give inspiration to younger people.
Tony Fauci, thank you so much for not being timid in speaking truth to power and for the service and the care that you've given to populations around the world, and for maintaining that integrity, both personally and in science. Thank you for joining this podcast.
Thank you very much. It's really a pleasure, and thank you for having me.
That was the Oxford Colloquy Trust in Science, bringing you the stories, people and facts behind the science. So you might be wondering, what is a colloquy? A colloquy is a discourse or conversation, and I hope you'll agree that that's what we've been having.